Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to the show. Before we get started here, I just want to say that I am really grateful that you have tuned into this show. I feel so lucky that I get to be a part of making a show about creativity, curiosity, and art, and that each week I get to sit down with the greatest minds of filmmaking, music, literature, acting, and even skateboarding, and I get to pick their brains about their creative process. And most of all, I feel lucky that people like you are listening in and that you're getting inspired and getting motivated by these conversations to make your own art and forge your own creative paths. If Off Camera can play some small part in your creative success, then I have the best job in the world. And I want to keep doing it forever. So that's where you come in. If you like what we are doing here and Off Camera has become something that you look forward to or count on, then I am humbly asking for your help. Here's an easy way to support the show. We just released Off Camera The Portraits, which is a big, beautiful, coffee table worthy 260-page book which captures every iconic artist that has appeared as a guest on Off Camera. It makes an incredible Christmas gift, and if you pre-order right now, you can get a limited signed edition for only $55, which will arrive at your door before Christmas. So visit the store at offcamera.com and pick up a copy for yourself and a copy for your mom, and copies for everyone else on your Christmas list. You will not only be getting a beautiful photography book filled with never-before-seen images, but you will be supporting Off Camera. It's a win-win. So, thanks for listening, and now on with the show. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got this way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor Sam Rockwell. Back in 1998, the New York Times ran a profile of up-and-coming actor Sam Rockwell, who had three films at Sundance that year. The headline called him a one-man gallery of rogues, crooks, and oddballs. Not many years later, critics' calls for award nominations began. His performance in Three Billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri might actually answer those calls. In it, he plays a small-town cop who's kind of funny, a bit dumb, and then maybe unhinged and possibly quite dangerous. He says that that alarming transformation is exactly what drew him to a role he might have otherwise turned down. Sam grew up in an acting family and went to a performing arts high school, but says he was more interested in pot and girls than acting. When he finally moved to New York to make a career of it, he learned just how much he didn't know. Thanks to a two-year Meisner program and demanding acting coaches, Sam developed a studious, technical approach that you never suspect in watching his loose performances. The cliche of an actor's actor truly applies here, and I think that's why so much of his work stands the test of time. Go back and watch Box of Moonlight, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and especially Moon, and you'll see what I mean. Sam's an actor who makes me nostalgic for the kind of films and actors we rarely see anymore, when being a leading man didn't require a modeling background or more muscles than depth. In this episode, Sam explains why it took George Clooney and a golf club for him to get his first big lead in a studio film. He also breaks down the technique behind some of his favorite roles and talks about the screen moments he'd redo if he could. You'll also hear why Robert Duvall is the guy and the importance of knowing just what kind of sick you are. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I've wanted to have you on here for a long time. As a matter of fact, you know, I think I saw Moon in 2009.
Oh, wow.
And I wanted to have you on the show even then, although I didn't have a show then.
Yeah.
And now you've made this film, Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri.
Yeah.
Which is a mouthful.
It is a mouthful.
Tell somebody about that title. But no, it's this incredible film about a woman who erects some billboards in town to try to spur the police department into looking into the death of her her daughter. And you play this really, like, not too smart, racist, Ozark area cop, right?
Yeah.
And I got to thinking that I don't know if I've ever seen you play a cop.
Yeah, I never played a cop in a movie. I did Law and Order. I did a cop once, but that's about it. So this was really exciting for me. It's kind of a red herring to the audience. You know, you think it's the comic relief, perhaps a benign villain or something, but, you know, and then it turns into something else that's so much more interesting, you know.
Now, when you say it's like a red herring, is that also a way in for you in terms of, oh, I can use that to the audience and I can play that up a little bit so that when he has his turn, it can be more impactful? Like,
absolutely. I mean, I joke that the arc of it is Barney Fife turns into Travis Bickle, you know, and that's a simplification.
But, right.
I mean, it was written that way, and the trick, I think, is that he's got to be goofy, but he has to also be dangerous, so you have to toe that line.
Right.
And I went to Southern Missouri and did some research. I did some ride-alongs with some cops and did a ride-along with a cop here in L.A., and that was really helpful. So we had some discussions about the haircut, you know, and sort of more superficial things like the sunglasses and stuff, and got some tidbits. Had this officer Josh McCullen tape my lines in a tape recorder. In fact, my dialect coach Liz Himmelstein found one cop, and he wasn't quite right. He didn't really have enough of a dialect. And Martin didn't want too much of a twang, but I wanted to do a little bit. So we had to have the right amount. So we taped this one cop, and he just didn't have enough of a twang. So I said to Liz, I said, I'm really sorry. I you know, because we spent like 2 hours taping this guy. I said, I think we got to find another cop, you know. So she found this guy, Josh McCullen, and he was perfect. And we taped him, and then I liked
him. Wait, I have to stop you. That's fascinating. So you actually give him the script and let him read your lines.
Yeah. I did that with Chuck Barris, too.
I did?
Yeah, I do that all the time. And Liz has found me... so many great people. She found me a cowboy in Arizona when I did Fool for Love.
Yeah, I would think that when you have to take on an accent, it's one part of the puzzle, right? Like, obviously, there's other things you have to do, but the accent seems like the surface. Like, you have to have that right.
You have to have that right. It's almost like a separate job.
Right. Now, do you get anything else off that tape other than just the accent?
Oh, certainly. Yes, you get ad-libs, you know. I remember getting Chuck Barris to do ad-libs, like... what would you say, you know? I mean, it's a Charlie Kaufman script, so you don't want to mess with it too much. It's just like this is a Martin McDonagh script. But, you know, Martin welcomed a couple of changes. He was okay with a couple of things. And so he said, instead of the county jail, Josh said the clank.
Oh, right.
And Martin liked that, so we kept that. And then he said, that was a line, he said, he just did it voluntarily. Josh said, just get out of my ass. And I really liked that, so I did that one of the takes to my fellow actor, Jelko Ivanek, who was playing the other deputy. And so it worked, you know. So you got to be careful with that stuff because it's, you don't want to ad lib, you know, it's garnish to the main meal, but it's...
Sure. Yeah, that's such an interesting and obviously easy way to do it, but I don't know if that's something that is widely known.
I know De Niro's done it. I don't know if he did it all the time, but I know he used to do it. I just think it's an easy way to get the sound.
Right, you know? Right. Well, in this film, this guy, Jason Dixon, is not smart. He's sort of still unnaturally connected to his mother. There's sort of a codependent relationship there. And he has reverence for his chief of police.
Yeah, that's right.
Played by Woody Harrelson.
That's right.
And what I'm curious about there is, okay, so the accent is your surface, but how do you then go about, especially when it's not someone you've grown up being around or someone that you can relate to, like his belief system, whatever it is, do you need to know that? Like, do you need to know his sort of history and why he still lives with his mother?
Absolutely. I'm not a big backstory guy, but I do think he was probably maybe abused by his father somehow, and that was a rough relationship. And he obviously has a very... codependent thing with his mom, which is kind of like, I think a little bit, although I don't really know Coriolanus too well, but I think it's similar to that, or it's weird, you know, it's got a little Glass Menagerie. So I piece it together. I have an acting coach that I work with. His name's Terry Knickerbocker.
Okay.
And I met him, he was subbing for the class I was in, this Meisner class, with a teacher named William Esper, who's pretty much the Sanford Meisner protege in the East, on the East Coast, and he is a two-year program. You study the Meisner technique. Duvall did the Meisner technique. A lot of people, a lot of really good actors did. And so we don't have to get into all that nerdy actor
tell
stuff.
Me, but tell like, me in but, a few but, sentences what yeah. How you would describe the Meisner technique.
Well, it's a very practical, shall we say, vocabulary and even, I wouldn't say science, but it's a way to break down a script into several acting problems that you then are able to solve.
Okay.
So there's a 2 + 2 = 4 solution, you know, and I think people think that acting is a mystical thing.
Yeah.
And it's some kind of magic trick. And to some extent it is, but I think there's a technique to acting. Otherwise, you know, anybody could do it. And I think that there is something to be said for, you know, the craft of acting and studying that craft and doing theater and stuff. So, for instance, you know, this whole thing about ad-libbing and, you know, actually paraphrasing is a legitimate rehearsal technique. And what I mean by that is that if you're doing an audition for, like, you know, the soap opera Young and the whatever or right. something, and you don't like the script and you're like having trouble, then what you can do is put it into your own words and take it off the page and say, well, what would you say, you know, to be or not to be? What would you say? Well, I don't know what to do. I want to fuck my mom's fucking my uncle or whatever. You'd say, you know, you'd go like, you'd put it in your own words, you know, I don't know whether to, you know, kill, you know, slit my throat. Or so you then go back to the text and then you say the text.
Ah.
And that's paraphrasing. And that's a legitimate rehearsal technique that was Meisner, I guess, came up with. You know?
So you learn how to have all the intentions behind your own words and you put those intentions.
Yeah, exactly. Into. And as if would be something. And as if is a substitution of particularization where you go, you know, okay, you're going to do this scene. It's you got to, I was in a movie, I played a KKK guy, and the guy comes, Nick Searcy, this actor, says, well, that's it, you know, our kids are going to that, they're going to have black kids go to our school, you know, and I can't really relate to that. I don't, but to me, the director said, you know, it's as if your son has cancer. So that's a particularization. That's a substitution, or what we call an as if. It's as if your son has cancer. So I don't care. I went to an interracial school, me, Sam.
Sure.
So I can't really relate to that. So that particularization, that as if, is helpful.
Right. So you don't have to do some magic trick of, I'm suddenly going to feel that way. And
yeah, if I'm playing Hitler or a racist, I can't all of a sudden be like, I'm not going to become anti-Semitic or
right.
something.
But you know what's interesting about that to me is that reveals, though, that you still have to believe that it's real. You're just putting an
yes.
as if in. But
yes.
for us as an audience to see it, you still have to find some way to believe
it. You have to find some way to personalize it, yeah.
Right.
That's right. And I think, you know, I've been saying this a lot lately. I talked with this ex-white supremacist, this guy Christian, who now pulls people out of hate groups. I had a very brief conversation with him, and he said, you know, it's not so much that you hate black people or brown people if you're a racist or a white supremacist, that you hate yourself. And that was really helpful when I was working on this part where I played a Ku Klux Klan guy. But it was also, I think, I kind of knew that with Dixon as well, instinctively. That
right, in this
Billboards
movie, because he's also a racist.
But he's got incredible low self-esteem, you know,
right.
and he lives with his mom, and, you know, he's kind of a loser, you know, nobody likes him in the town. He's kind of a leper in the town because he supposedly tortured this black guy in custody. And so that's something where, you know, he's got a little bit of a Napoleonic complex. And so you start with, how am I going to feel like that is, you know, I guess Gene Hackman said something once. He said, you know, you start with what traits does the character have that I have that are similar?
Right.
And you start from there. You go, well, I'm not a dangerous person necessarily, but we're all capable of whatever. And I think you just sort of start with that. What do I have in common with this guy?
Or what could I do under
What could I do under those imaginary circumstances?
Right.
Yeah, if I were a cop in this small town, and this was my reality. Well, how would I deal with this?
Using that as if idea, yeah. How do you dumb yourself down?
Yeah.
You know, like there's a scene in this new Billboards movie.
Yeah.
Where Frances McDormand comes in and calls you a name and you respond to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Joe Kivonik says, don't answer when she calls you that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's a little pause by you. Like, you're trying to work that out. Like, it's not like immediately. It's not even an immediate dumb guy. It's like, now wait a minute. Let me,
it's interesting. I don't think of Dixon as dumb, but I think of him as, Sam can be a bit scattered or distracted sometimes. And that, you know, I think Christopher Walken said once, I'm not a dangerous guy, but because I maybe come from a bohemian background, or I was a theater kid, or eccentricity sometimes equates as danger in front of the camera. You know what I mean? So like my kind of absent-minded professor quality in real life, which I have a little bit. I sometimes have a delayed response to a question or something because I kind of have a vivid imagination. I kind of space out sometimes, and I'm often kind of thinking about, I free associate and I'm thinking about other things. So if you say surfing, I'll start thinking of Laird Hamilton, and then I'll think of my friend Brian Garrity, and then I'll think, oh, I got to get a beer with Brian. So I'm like off doing all these things, you know. I think on camera, I can accentuate that, and it equates as kind of dumb or whatever, or kind of absent-minded. And really, that's just me going, just really trying to process the moment, but just taking my time. And it's actually fairly authentic. I'm not really putting on it. But you're right, it's hard to be an innocent to play that kind of Forrest Gump or like Tim Robbins and Bull Durham. That's not an easy thing to do.
Right.
Or what Tom Hanks did in Big, I think, is to be childlike is, I think, an extremely hard thing to do.
What do you think that is? Because obviously Picasso's famous quote is, I spent my whole life trying to learn to draw like a child.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And I wonder what...
Yeah, what that's interesting.
...quality or what work it takes to do that very thing you're talking about.
You know, my buddy Matt Ross, he says, you know, having a baby... Having a kid, a young child, toddler, is like hanging out with a drunk, crazy person.
It's
true. You know what I mean?
Oh, as someone with three kids, it's true.
You know what I'm talking about?
It is literally like,
it's like,
go to bed. Like, go to bed.
You know, it's like they're like laughing, crying. Yeah, go to bed. They're like crazy.
They're not going to bed. They haven't destroyed the whole house yet.
So, I mean, that's kind of what, when you do acting training, that's sort of what they encourage you to access, that side of yourself, which is why I think it's hilarious when people are sort of puzzled when actors have temper tantrums on a set or something. And I'm like, what's the big, puzzle about that? You hired an actor, you're paying this person to basically be a child on camera. You think that's not going to spill over into real life once in a while?
Just because someone arbitrarily says cut?
Yeah.
You're going to transform into an adult, like corporate executive?
Yeah, it's like, exactly. Like all of a sudden we got to be responsible now. We got to go like shake hands and, you know, it's like, no, this is what we were trained to do. We're trained to be like, blah, 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 you know. And so I think it's so funny when people are like, whoa, now you got to be an adult. We yelled cut. Yeah, that's not quite how it works. You know, there's a little spillover.
Yeah.
And I think I heard Jeff Bridges paces before he has an emotional scene or something. I've taken a umbrella and broken it over some rubber trash cans, and I broke a chair in the last thing I did. You know, it was fine. Nobody cared. It was in a room and it was an old chair, but I was trying to get it up for the scene, and it was a heavy scene, and you do what you got to do. You know?
In other words, you're just saying you can't just turn that stuff on and off.
I can't. Some people can. I think the great late Phil Hoffman, who was a friend of mine, I think he had that volcano kind of simmering at all times. I think he paid a price for it too. But I'm not like that. I don't. I think maybe John Malkovich has that quality. He can just kind of like explode. Maybe Gary Oldman. I gotta have a few, espressos, you know, work up and listen to some music, whatever, you know.
Like, do you think that watching yourself over the years, you've learned from it, or do you think sometimes that just like that thing of trying to retain a childlike quality, if it's better not to know too much about, like, if you got too good at observing yourself on the monitor or whatever, could you lose something, or is that something that you can really take and learn from?
When I watch something, if it's good, I like it, and if it's not good, if I see a moment, a missed opportunity, then that hurts a little bit, and I go, oh, I could have, you know, I should have done.
That's
that,
interesting.
You know, I could have lifted that moment up a little more, or, you know, but like, you know, or maybe that wasn't full enough. That could have been a fuller moment. If I haven't squeezed everything out of the scene, then I'm not happy. You know, I want to squeeze everything. That's why I like a lot of time to prepare, because I want to kind of marinate in it a little and give myself time. Because, you know, on a set, you don't have the lug. You do 3-4 takes now, the budgets they have now.
Well, that's what's crazy to me, and especially talking to someone like you who's done a lot of theater.
Yeah.
You get so much time to prepare, and even when you're up and live and running, you're developing that character. But on a film, you're supposed to know exactly where you're supposed to be emotionally, at whatever page you're on.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be able to get there, and that's supposed to be in concert with what's going to happen later that you haven't shot, or what's going to happen earlier.
It's funny, man.
What's the work that you have to do every time?
I think it's nonstop script analysis. You got to keep going back to the script and kind of going over, where am I coming from? Look at your notes. You know, you got your notes in there.
What kind of notes do you make?
My notes look like a 5-year-old's writing. I mean, literally.
Really?
Like, sometimes I'll have a happy face and literally like a sad face. Or like, I mean, it's so rudimentary.
The secret to acting, folks.
No, I mean, it's so...
This scene, me happy.
Dude, sometimes it's as simple as that. But often those faces will be on the opposite kind of scene, too. Stanislavski has a thing called opposites where... So Chris Walken's a master of that, you know, where he takes all the punctuation out. And he will take a line... Like when you watch Biloxi Blues... I read the play once out loud with some friends, and I read the sergeant, the Chris Walken part. And if you read the Broadway play, that first speech that he has where he's talking to all the soldiers, it has nothing but exclamation points throughout the whole
written
speech, written with Neil Simon wrote exclamation points. Ten hut! You know, it's like that kind of thing. And when you watch the movie, Chris Walken, the Mike Nichols movie, he doesn't raise his voice at all. You know, he just, ten hut, you know, he does just that kind of like tone. And that's why Chris is a genius, because he takes something and he just says, well, I'm going to do the other thing. I'm going to go the other way. And that's theater, because Chris did all these great parts. He did Romeo and Hamlet. He did Coriolanus. He did all these, you know, he did Streetcar Named Desire. And so I always say, you know, when he gets to that monologue in Pulp Fiction, he's already done all that theater. So he's chewed on all that text, you know?
Yeah.
So that Pulp Fiction monologue is nothing, because he's just doing, he's done all these soliloquies, you know?
What do you get in the theater that you just can never get on a film in terms of the script?
Well, you know, in a film, you act maybe 5 minutes out of a 12, 14-hour day. So with the 5 concentrated minutes, if that, you know? And then...
Yeah.
In a play, you act the entire story in 2 hours, 3 hours, you know.
And maybe 3 times that day. And
maybe three times, yeah.
It sounds like, to me, hearing you discuss Stanislavski and Meisner.
Yeah.
And
geek out, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a work ethic there, and there's a discipline, and there's like a studious nature. Like, is that you by nature?
Yeah.
Were you a studious guy?
No, I was terrible in school. I was really a dilettante with acting until I went to William Esper.
What do you mean?
And I met Terry Knickerbocker too, and a woman named Maggie Flanagan, who was very helpful. I did some acting with my mom when I was a kid, and my parents were actors for a while, and I went to a performing arts high school in San Francisco, but I really didn't take it seriously. You know, I smoked pot, I chased girls, and I I didn't really take it seriously. I kind of grew up in it, and I took it for granted. And then I went to New York and did some restaurant jobs and did all that stuff. Started booking like commercials and
right.
did a couple of movies, like small parts. And
was it like, oh, this is easy, I know how to do this, I saw my parents do it?
Yeah, exactly. I knew enough about acting because I grew up in the theater with my mom and stuff. But I didn't really know what the fuck I was doing, you know what I mean? And I did learn from watching the adults act and stuff, but you gotta go train and figure it out, and whatever that means, that can be on the job training or just doing a play. But there's an apprenticeship, you know, like in London, that's not here as much, and I think that's too bad, because I think, you know, there's a tradition in London or the conservatory, some, and here Yale or Juilliard, where you play the small part, you know, and then you play Horatio, and then you play Laertes, and then you play Hamlet.
Right, right.
And we don't have that as much here, and it's sad. And I had a little bit of that because I didn't become famous overnight. But I was a bar back and a busboy, and then I was kind of getting like commercials, like TV commercials, which you could do back then, and well, now you can't again, I guess. Now it's all changed. But and I went to Bill Esper for the summer session, which is like a 6-week.
How old were you?
I was 24.
Okay, so now you weren't 19 and doing this.
No, I was doing. So I was booking a couple of jobs.
Okay, so what was the impetus for? I need to know more. Walls were you running, or what ceiling were you bumping up against?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think it was like, I think I was just not able to be consistent. I think I would go into the room and it would be kind of loosey-goosey and I'd get lucky.
Isn't that funny? Because I think that's the definition of a professional versus anybody else's.
Yeah.
A professional, like, I always relate it to terms of photography of anyone can get lucky and take a good picture.
Sure.
But can you take a good picture at 3:00 next Tuesday?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. That's the point, is can you do that at 3:00 next Tuesday? And you know, can you do, you know, Medea when you're in a good mood? You know,
right.
Can you do Schindler's List? You know, you got to do the last. And, you know, you just got married or whatever,
right,
you know,
right.
Whatever, you know, it's like you're having a good day and then you got to have a bad day. So the training really, so I did the summer session and I said, well, that's good. I'm good. 6 weeks. I'm good. And Bill said, well, why don't you do the 2-year program? And I said, well, I'm very busy, Bill. You know, I got a call back for a Colgate commercial. I'm really, I think I'm up for this Law and Order. It's like 5 lines. I'm moving, man. He's like, yeah, don't worry, kid. I think you could be, well, just do it, you know, and if you get work, we'll talk about it. And just, you know, it'll go by like that. And so I started and I did it, and it changed my life. And it really taught me the kind of responsibility you have.
Do you remember when you found out how much there was to know, or when you felt like you changed as an artist?
There were pivotal moments during the training where I would have what you'd call a breakthrough or something.
Okay.
I was doing a play at the time in my first year, and it was about child abuse, and my wife in the play, Kelly Overby, abused. We find out that she beat the kid, threw the kid down the stairs, and the play's called Face Divided, and so I would describe her, our child's face at the end of the play, and when I would do it, you know, I somehow one night I got very connected to it, and I felt like I was actually, you know, telling somebody that my daughter, what my daughter looks like. That she's
so
got,
it was truthful to you.
It was really truthful, like she's got wires in her jaw, and this is what she looks like. And so it came to life for me, and it happened in class one time. We do these things called activities, and I came, and somebody comes to the door, you have a preparation. And I came in, and I had some preparation, and I hadn't been doing well in the class at all. Bill had been reaming me out. I was really lazy, and he called me out on it. And he, you know, really was on my case. And he said, you gotta apply yourself more. This is bullshit. And then I went, and I did this preparation, and somehow I came to life in the room. And I remember you know, it's a completely safe environment. But the actress I was with was, I remember sort of, I was kind of in a daze, and when it was over, I saw her in the corner. She was kind of like afraid of me. And I had been pacing and screaming, and it was just like, it was almost like like I saw red. It was a crazy experience, you know. But it was all supervised, of course, in a classroom, and everybody's fine, and she's fine, and we all, you know. But that's what's great about an acting class is like, it's a safe environment to do something like that. You know, you should feel safe to be able to explore those kind of things. Something, you know, happened, and Bill said, you know, that I think that you had a bit of a breakthrough today. I think that's a.
And he didn't have to tell you that for you to know that, right?
I kind of knew something had happened. It was kind of an outer body experience. So you feel like kind of like, I mean, not to be dramatic, but it feels like, you know, Jedi training or something, or like, you know, training or something. You know, you feel like you're really. You were so scared of disappointing the teacher that when you went out into the real world for the casting director, that wasn't scary anymore.
Oh, really? So,
you know?
So was it a distinctly different experience going out for work after being in that?
Oh, yeah. Because whatever their expectations were, they were never going to be as high as Bill's, you know.
Or as your own, right?
Or as my own, but that later became my own standards, you know.
Right. And it's interesting to hear how much of a technical side you come from, or how much,
oh, yeah.
of a, you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah,
thinking
yeah.
about some of the things you've done, and,
yeah.
you know, whatever, from Box of Moonlight to yeah. Seven Psychopaths to where there's a looseness to it.
Yeah.
I would, as a non-actor, think, oh, that's just channeling something on that day.
Yeah, yeah, and sometimes it is. Sometimes you use your environment and you take what you, you know, if something is inspiring you, but I think that you got to do your homework and then you're open to stuff. And I think then you can maybe be relaxed enough that you can appear to be unhinged or really be unhinged in that moment, you know. And there is some danger in the moment, you know, which is what I think we all want to see, you know. We don't want to see, like, I think we want to see a little rock and roll in front of that.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't think we go to see ourselves. I think we go to see our interior lives. I don't think we go to see our exterior lives. We go to see the thing we wish we would have said or the thing we wish we would have
done.
Yeah,
yeah, man.
Or the risk that we wish we would have taken.
Absolutely. It wants to be cathartic, I think, for all of us, yeah.
I'm curious about what makes, in your mind, a performance great. Like, what elevates a performance for you?
That's interesting, because Bill used to say, you know, you have to have an opinion about acting. That doesn't mean you need to share it with everyone, but you must have an opinion. You must have an opinion. And that was, and so you do become a critic and you have a standard. I'm thinking of Meryl Streep in she plays the Prime Minister in that movie.
Oh, was it The Iron Lady?
Yeah, yeah. I was blown away by her in that. But something like that, or her in Sophie's Choice, or her in anything, you know, or Gene Hackman, or, you know, Duvall or Dustin Hoffman, or, you know, John Voight and so many things, and De Niro, and, you know.
As someone who does it, are you more impressed with the fact that you can't see the architecture of what they're doing? Like, is that what makes a good performance
yes,
to you?
Yes, I think that, I think simply that is what it is, yeah. If you don't see the acting, I don't want to see the acting. I think that's why Duvall is the master, you know, in a sense.
Because you know he's acting.
You know he's acting, but I think we were doing a round table and Tom Hanks was talking about Duvall.
Uh-huh.
And we all kind of lit up, you know, Duvall's sort of, he's the guy. You know, he's the guy, you know. And they're all the guys, you know, all those
Why
guys.
Why is he the guy?
Well, because,
in your opinion,
pound for pound, you know, I mean, all those guys are amazing, but there's the transformational aspect of Duvall, and then there's the just no acting. There's no acting. You know, when you see Lonesome Dove, they've just taken a Texas Ranger and put him in a time machine, you know, and he's here in front of this camera.
Right, right.
There's no actor. It's a fucking Texas Ranger, you know. It's amazing.
Does that make you want to quit or does that make you want to?
No, quite the contrary. It makes me want to, it inspires me. It, in fact, when, you know, when Phil died, it was like, you know, because he was a dear friend and he directed me in a play. You know, and I said to Billy Crudup, I said, what the hell are we going to do now? You know, like, who are we going to, you know, it's like, because it was me, Liev, and Billy, and Jeffrey Wright, and, you know, Michael Shannon, and Mark Ruffalo, and you know, Josh Brolin, all these amazing actors. And, you know, Phil was the guy, I think, of our generation. And, it, you know, you ever see that Magic Johnson, Larry Bird documentary?
Yes, yes.
The 30 for 30, where they, you know, they raised their game. You know, the two of them, they raised each other's game, you know. And that, to me, is healthy competition. You know, where you see somebody and it makes you want to be better, as opposed to, like, you know, unhealthy envy competition stuff, which can eat you alive. I think that's bad energy.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. And if you'll lend me your ear for a minute, I want to tell you a little bit about today's sponsor, Ring. Over 1 million people use the amazing Ring video doorbell to help protect their homes. And Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. Ring knows home security begins at the front door, but it doesn't end there. So now they're extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like Ring's amazing doorbell, the Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and a floodlight that connects right to your phone with HD video and two-way audio that lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. See and speak to visitors, and even set off an alarm right from your phone. With Ring's Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. So if you're wondering how to support Off Camera and you want to improve your home security, well, this is the perfect moment for you. You can save up to $150 off a Ring security kit when you go to ring.com/offcamera. That's ring.com/offcamera. And when you put that code in, they know that you listen to us, and that really helps our show. So check it out. With Ring, you're always home. Now back to the show.
Your first, I would say, big role, and tell me if I'm wrong, but was Box of Moonlight.
Yeah,
where you
right.
really got to stretch
yeah.
on screen, right? And I think of that film, even though it came out in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
90s,
yeah.
It feels like a movie from the 1970s.
It does, doesn't it?
And it got me thinking, like, I rewatched that film when I knew you were coming in. And,
oh,
and
wow.
I had a lot of nostalgia for not only that kind of filmmaking,
yeah.
but for that America. And in that, you play a character, he's kind of a man boy that runs around in a coonskin cap, and he lives off the grid and steals his phone line from, you know, the government, and you eat Oreos for breakfast, and
yeah.
you steal tomatoes from your neighbor, and you swim naked in the quarry.
And great role.
And, yeah. it, you know, I wonder how getting that role early in your career kind of set the die, and I also wonder, looking back, what your memories are of the kind of acting you thought you were doing then
yes.
versus now knowing what you know.
I saw it a couple of years ago, and it made me cringe because I look so tense. So
yeah,
it's
that what happens you say, when you look at younger you, acting is hard.
Oh, God, I was just schmacking my brains out. I saw a Hitchhiker's Guide the other night. It came on, and I was like, wow, that's a lot of acting, Sammy. You better, wow, I'm glad you got that out of your system.
But I wonder if what you don't see is the youth on you, like the spirit.
That there's well, yeah. That character was very kinetic. I think you're absolutely right. And you have this image of yourself, you know. And that was not my MO at that time. I was not wanting to do parts that were boyish and excited and exuberant. You know,
is like, that true?
No, I did not. I mean, the way I kind of connected to that particular part was I kind of connected to like. This, for lack of a better term, this kind of young Gary Busey,
yeah.
The great white hunter kind of thing. And through that, I found, when I initially went in for the audition, I did a whole kind of like a cowboy character.
Okay.
And then he wanted me to pull back the cowboy and just do this boy. And that was tough for me, this kind of Peter Pan thing, because I was, you know,
you wanted to be seen in a different way.
Yeah, I was watching Mean Streets and Goodfellas.
But you were a Peter Pan character.
It was such a Peter Pan character.
Yeah.
It was so hard to do.
It's funny. You know, I was in bands growing up, and if I go and listen, to this day, if I go listen to old music I made, I don't even want to play it for my wife and kids because I don't want them to not see me as I am. Like, it's
yeah.
that, it's, but it's, I'm sure, my own experience and nobody else's.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Totally. So it's a nightmare, isn't it? You're just like, no, you just
you
don't
see all the things that you think make you not a man, maybe, or not a, not, you know, like, you were probably watching that and going, this is nothing like Mean Streets.
Nothing like Mean Streets.
Where, but what it was is this beautiful time in life. And,
yeah.
You know, I was thinking about Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Yeah.
What's notable about that whole, like the business side of that, is that, you know, it's pretty well known how George fought for you to be in that film.
That's right.
And for him to stand up and go, okay, these people have more foreign box office value or something, yeah. but I really want this guy.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that looked from like from your side, because...
It was bananas, yeah.
I would think that while that would be very flattering on one hand, part of it would be like, oh, wait a minute here. You know, you're going to bat against studios and everything.
Yeah.
Like, did that add pressure?
Absolutely. You know, we had an old-fashioned screen test with, like, dollies and tracks and costumes. It was an old-fashioned, with real film.
Really?
Ellen Pompeo was the reader. And what I didn't realize is there were other actors auditioning, and Harvey Weinstein had approval. And had, you know, Steven Soderbergh was also part of the muscle there. You know, Steven Soderbergh and George teamed up against Harvey to get me that part. And Harvey didn't want me for the part.
Well, we found he has questionable judgment across
yes,
the board.
Yes, apparently, yes. So there you go. But I think George put a golf club through his office wall.
Is that true?
Once having a conversation, maybe with Harvey. I don't know. Yeah, arguing about whether I should be in the movie.
So were you made aware of all of this going on behind the scenes?
George tried to protect me from it, but inevitably I found out because it took a while to get an answer after the screen test. And so, and after the screen test, I asked him what was going on. And he kind of said, well, you know, this person and this person and that person and this person. But there were so many people attached to play that part. You know, I think Johnny Depp, Robert Downey Jr., and there were all these people talked about it for it. And they get an Norton at one point. So he said, don't worry about it. You're my guy. You don't worry about it. And I said, well, listen, if it doesn't work out, let's be friends, you know? Like, you know. And he's like, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You know, so I got this, you know, so that was kind of his attitude. And in fact, he did have it, and him and Soderbergh, you know, fought for me. Because when they saw the screen, you know, he went, hey, well, this is the guy. This is the guy, you know. So, but yeah, it was an amazing experience to do that with George. I learned so much from
what
him.
What kind of anxiety did you experience after getting the role, when it was finally?
Terrible. Terrible.
Like, describe what you go through in those situations.
Oh, my God. It was unbelievable. I was going to star in a studio movie opposite Julia Roberts and Drew Barrymore and George Clooney. And I was the lead. I had to carry this movie.
Yeah. Playing, and Brad Pitt and Matt
Brad
Damon.
Pitt and Matt
the
Damon
movie.
Did a cameo.
That's right.
So, you know, and I was the guy. I was the guy in the fucking movie. And I had to do this crazy impression of this very, you know, eccentric guy. And the Gong shows, I had to watch the Gong show, you know, so it was a Charlie Kaufman script.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, gold. And so it was a big deal. It was a big deal. And so I would weekly have anxiety attacks, you know, and have to get through them. And my acting coach would have to talk me down. Him and my friend Ivan would be reading it. And I'd have to stop and go like, all right, I gotta just go to the kitchen for a second, or, you know.
Really?
You know, I'd have to like gather myself a little.
What was, ultimately provided the?
I think just work, after working on it so much, I realized that I knew what I was doing and I was the guy, I was the right guy.
Isn't that funny how you have to like relearn that lesson
yeah,
over and over?
Yeah, over and over. Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know what it is, man. You know, I think it's when it's costly,
yeah.
You know, you get nervous again. I remember doing Frost Nixon. I felt that was a costly endeavor
yeah.
for me,
yeah.
you know? I don't know why. I think maybe because it was about Watergate, which feels like an important topic. And
it's always hard to see yourself as, like, I find this too, like I always look at my parents' generation and the men of them, and they go, those are the serious guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're the guys that are one step away from being thrown out of the room because we don't belong here.
No, exactly.
Do you have that?
Absolutely. No, I feel like, yeah, I'm going to play like a smart person in Frost Nixon. Yeah, that's acting, you know what I mean? And then doing Fool for Love on Broadway was very costly. That was a legendary production with Ed Harris and Kathy Baker that people still talk about.
Yeah.
30 years ago. Not only were we going to do it in New York, we were going to do it on Broadway.
Does that anxiety, does it crop back up when you're doing theater?
Yeah.
Even after you've done all the work?
Like, yeah.
Does it have a way to hit you, like, right before opening night, what you're about to do?
It can. And you have to talk yourself through that. And you have to, and I think Laird Hamilton actually talks about this in the documentary, but I think you have to, you kind of have to make friends with fear, I think. When you're doing live theater or you're doing whatever you got to do, you know, and it's scary, you have to, at a certain point, you have to kind of give over, and you can't fight that feeling. You're going to have to embrace that feeling. Is going to overwhelm you, and if you don't make friends with it, it's going to suck you down into the swamp, you know?
I would imagine it's overwhelming.
I think with the difference now is with experience, fear, it still scares you. You still have those feelings, but what happens with experience is it makes you sharper, so you become like a laser. I think experience teaches you that fear becomes your friend, and it actually makes you like razor sharp.
What sticks out as your mind is the time when you were most overwhelmed?
Oh God, I mean, there's so many little movies I did that where I was like, you know, I once went on a set for NYPD Blue, and and I had prepared, and this director, she kind of turned on me a little, and I didn't know. I prepared a junkie, like a heroin impediment, you know, like kind of, which is kind of like, you know, nodding out and kind of, hey man, you know, like that kind of thing. And I went to set thinking I was doing a heroin impediment for this drug addict I was going to play. Like, it was a little day player part.
Yeah.
And she says, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean? I don't understand." And she's like, "What are you doing? That's totally wrong. That energy is totally wrong." I was like, "I don't understand. I'm a heroin." She said, "No, not heroin. It's crack. You're supposed to be a crack addict. I need a jittery energy from you. It's supposed to be, it's totally wrong." I'm like, "Oh, okay. Let me go. I'm going to go figure it out. And I didn't want to get fired, you know, so I'm like, okay. So I go in my little fucking honey wagon, you know, and I go in there and I'm like, I call my acting coach, Terry or whatever. I called somebody. And I said, "What the fuck do I do?" You know. They said, "You know, it's okay. Just, you know, just change it up. You know, maybe have a cup of coffee. You know, whatever." And you know, whatever. I talked myself through it, and I did whatever I did on the show, and it was probably terrible. But I was like, it's overwhelming. You're like, you know,
yeah.
You're like, what the fuck?
Well,
is
and there's
to
a whole crew standing yeah. around, and now obviously being experienced, you look back and you go, "What a horrible director!
What a horrible thing to say to him!"
Yeah,
like, what? No, that's not what you do.
No, that's not how you get a good performance.
No,
from somebody.
No, you know. So, I don't know. It can happen at any time. You know.
Still, so
sure.
You still get scared.
Always, but there's this great moment, like when you get on stage. Where you just kind of go, or you get in front of a camera, and you know you're about to do this, and you know, Clint Eastwood says, I think he says, he doesn't say action, he says whenever you're ready, which I love, you know, I think that's what Brando used to. You just be like, just because you say action doesn't mean I have to do anything, you know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's that moment where
that's
you go,
the way to give it back to the director.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a moment where you go, okay, everybody's done their thing, and they're doing the focus, and they're doing the lights, and they're doing the clothes, and okay, now, this is my time. This is my time. And now, I don't play. I mean business. This is my church now. And when they yell cut or whatever, then it's your time again, and you can tweak, you do little tweaks or whatever you gotta do. But when that little bubble is so precious, you know, and you go, that's the time to, like, where you just, you become, you know, whatever, a man or whatever you want to call it. You become a warrior. I've learned so much from actors like Gene Hackman once. There was a thing he did, and, you know, we did a David Mamet movie, Heist, but he had to get angry at me in this car. And, you know, a cinematographer will sometimes try to talk you into doing certain things, and you accommodate them, and sometimes
That's good for the camera.
It's good for the camera. And, you know, I think George and I used to even say today's camera day or today's acting day or today's both, today's camera day and acting day. I say to George, is this acting day or is this camera day? He says, well, it's both. You know, I'd be like, okay, all right, lay it on me. What do we got to do? So you got to accommodate the camera, or sometimes the camera's got to accommodate you. So it was a lesson I learned once from Hackman. We were in this car, and I'm in the driver's seat. He's got to read me the riot act. I just did something really stupid, and he's going to yell at me for being an idiot. And so he has to get, he has to get hot. So the guys are going, Gene, can you just give me a little more by the dashboard. If you could just put your, and he goes, hey guys, don't hem me in, okay? I got to be able to move around here. And they were like, okay, no worries, Gene. And he wasn't a dick. He was just saying, he was protecting himself. He was saying, guys, you're going to have to accommodate me now. This is my turn now. And he had to be emotional. He had to be emotional in the scene. He had to yell at me. So that was him protecting himself. And I thought that was an invaluable lesson. I never forgot that.
Right, because you worried, if I tell the cameraman that, is he gonna?
Yeah, because you work with these.
Is he gonna think of me differently, or is he gonna now? He's gonna make it harder on me to.
No, you're working with. Sometimes you work. If you're lucky enough to work with like Roger Deakins or somebody.
Yeah.
And Roger's very accommodating, but like sometimes they'll say in a very nice way. They'll be like, you're driving or something, and you'll be like, can you just go down a little bit and get, I'll be like, okay, yeah, sure. Is that okay? Am I in the frame? They're like, just a little bit more, And you're like, okay, that's it. And then you can't even drive, You're like,
let alone act.
Yeah, let alone act,
Unless but you're in the frame, a turtle.
Yeah. So, you got to toe the line, but it's interesting.
Well, I have to ask you about Moon.
Yeah.
Because that's a film I regard it as one of the best science fiction films of all time. I don't know how much it was seen, but this is a film made by Duncan Jones. You're the only actor in the film. And there's a few scenes of your wife pre-taped back on Earth and a flashback with her, but really it's you and your clone.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that had to be one of the hardest jobs you've ever had to do. I mean, you're carrying the whole film by yourself. You have to be in this horrible state.
Yeah.
And you don't have anyone to talk to.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say that film, what memories come to your mind about that?
I mean, I saw Duncan today. I saw him today. It was so weird. I recently got to tell Dustin Hoffman at this event that I saw him at the Governor Awards, and I got to tell him that I completely stole the sick clone was a total ripoff of Ratso in Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, Midnight Cowboy.
The cough, the whole sickness. Because Duncan and I talked about, I said, what kind of a sickness are we talking about here? Is it like a flu, malaria? Like, what are you, tuberculosis? Like, what are we talking?
Is it heroin or is it crack?
Is it heroin or crack? Exactly. And so we talked about it. Is it HIV? Like, what is the, and he said, no, it's more like a really bad flu. And I said, well, that sounds kind of like Ratso in Midnight Cowboy, like a kind of a cough thing. And my acting coach, Terry, he said, why don't you watch Midnight Cowboy because of the buddy aspect? Not so much for the sick thing, but...
Because there's an antagonistic buddy thing going on.
Yeah, and they're total opposites.
Yeah.
Joe Buck and Ratso. So that was a great note. And then I watched Dead Ringers. And in fact, Duncan watched a lot of... We watched the DVD extras on the motion control camera that they used to do that effect, which they're doing on the Deuce now and they've done since then. But the first time I ever saw that trick done as well as it's ever been done was Jeremy Irons in Dead Ringers. And that was just an acting lesson. And he talked about what he would do was very subtle because they didn't really change the hairstyle too much in the two twins.
Right.
But he talked about a different energy, contrasting energies. And that was really helpful because it would help separate the clones or the twins per se, and that if one guy's kind of jittery, then the other guy should maybe be the opposite of that, So that would help distinguish who these guys were because you might get confused. In fact, Duncan was worried that the audience would get confused, and he wanted me to have a fake beard and the long hair, which we had in the beginning, but he wanted me to have that for one of the clones the whole movie. And I said, you know, we had this really cheesy beard. It didn't work. And
oh, so you tried it?
We tried it, you know. I think I had a real beard and I shaved it in the movie. And then we were going to use a, we were toying with a fake thing and this and that. And I said, Duncan, this looks like shit, man. This is not going to look good. I said, you just got to trust that I'm going to be able to do the acting. And they're going to know which clone is which. You just got to trust me. I can do it.
Now, again, when he says, okay, I'm going to trust you, is the anxiety level ratchet up?
Big time.
And there's a fragile state to the whole thing, too, especially, like, I feel like as your character finds out what he is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that his entire reason for being or his entire foundation is gone.
Yes, yes.
Like, that's an incredibly fragile place to be as a human being, to find out something like that.
I still don't think I did that, did go as deep as I should have with that scene. I know that scene. I think I could have gone a little deeper with that.
But, you know, it's funny. I know the exact scene you're talking about, and I remember watching it again a couple days ago and thinking, that choice was so brilliant because he wasn't going to let himself, like, be taken over by the pain. So I thought if you'd gone any further, I thought it was perfect. I thought
that's
the Duvall aspect of there's no acting there at all.
Well, sometimes you have a thing in your head of what you think the moment needs to be, and you put all this responsibility on the moment. Okay, the guy's going to tell me I'm not even a human being. I'm a clone, you know. So it's so big.
Where's the as if there?
How do you act that? So you got to figure it
out. Well, I was asking you that.
I don't know, you know. So you got to figure it out. It's very tough.
I would imagine that would be tough. Where does Meisner fit into? Where's the as if of you find out you're a clone?
I don't know. I still don't know. I still don't think I've solved that problem. But I know that. I remember talking, I got to talk with Holly Hunter once about acting, and she said, you know, sometimes if you don't nail a moment, she just recently did a great podcast that I listened to. It was fucking amazing. And she said, if you don't nail a moment, and you want, maybe you get to look at some of the dailies or you don't, or you just know you didn't, and, you know, you can always make it up maybe in another scene. And I never forgot that you could be like, okay, so maybe I didn't get it in this scene, but maybe I can hit that color or that note in a different scene, you know. And so the moment I feel that I am proud of is when he says, you know, I want to go home, and he's in the spaceship. That moment I was happy with. And maybe that's when it all comes to fruition.
Well, it's funny to hear you break apart your performance and break it down a little bit, because I just find that film to be so, it's overwhelmingly good. And
thanks, yeah.
I wonder if you are hard on yourself after the fact, even on a film like that where that's clearly some of the best work of anybody's career. And
thanks, man.
But it's interesting you could still be hard on yourself about that.
I still go over moments. Yeah, there's still moments. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of it I'm very happy with.
What does it feel like when you put so much work into a film?
And nobody sees it.
Yes, yeah. And nobody sees it.
It's heartbreaking. Yeah, nobody sees the fucking, it's tragic. It's tragic. So that's why it's exciting that Three Billboards is getting a lot of attention, because that's not enough to be good in a movie, and it's not enough to be good in a good movie. Something you got to be good in a good movie that people see.
The triumvirate.
Yeah, yeah. You
need all three things.
You need all three things, man.
Performance. That not only you were good, the film was good, and that people actually went to see it.
And people, for some reason, it catches on, and that's so random.
Do you ever feel underappreciated?
I mean, you know, I think we all feel that at some point. I feel pretty lucky. I've had a great career. I've been in some amazing films, you know. A lot of my film, you know, with the exception of maybe The Green Mile and Charlie's Angels, a lot of stuff that I've done has had afterlife, like Galaxy Quest or Assassination of Jesse James.
Yep.
Did not do necessarily that great, especially Jesse James, when they came out. But then, since then, they are revered as really great movies, you know.
Well, that's probably the best test for a film anyway.
Yeah.
Does it stand the test of time? Does it hold up? I mean, you can still go watch Midnight Cowboy and you're riveted to it. And a lot of films are a product of their time only.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about is maybe it's delayed gratification.
It's delayed gratification, but people, when people come up to you and they talk about Galaxy Quest or whatever, that's a really nice feeling, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good movie.
Yeah. Well, what I think you've managed to do as an artist is create a career that, compared to most of your peers, is more undefined and still holds the possibility for a wider potential of roles, right?
Yeah, thanks, man. I feel, you know, blessed, I guess is the word. I'm not religious, but I do feel lucky. I've had some great opportunities. It's good. It's a good life. You know, you gotta appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming in.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you telling me these stories. And
I appreciate you asking good questions and we're having a real conversation. You know.
I appreciate your socks and your shirt.
I appreciate your shoes and the studio and the lights.
Very nice to chat with you. Thank you.
Very nice, man. Thanks. Thanks, Sam. Thanks a lot.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And if you're like me, when you hear a few of these stories, you can't help but get excited about watching the films that the stories are about. And I would suggest you do just that. Start with Moon, check out Box of Moonlight, watch Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, go deep into Sam's career. It's a rewarding journey and it's full of amazing performances. And if you want your minds blown, watch both of the Martin McDonagh films that Sam is in, Seven Psychopaths and the new Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. And then if you really want your mind blown, go to offcamera.com. Do you know that we've already done 127 episodes and you can watch them all by getting a subscription to Off Camera? For only $4.99 a month, you can experience the totality of the archive in glorious black and white. Yes, the podcast is great, but seeing these people tell their stories and watching their expressions is quite an experience, and you can do it on any device you like as many times as you want in the comfort of your own home. So check that out. You can also get the new off-camera book called Off Camera the Portraits, just in time for the holiday season. And if you go right now and pre-order the book and type in the code OCBOOK at checkout, you can get an additional 10% off and I will sign your copy. It makes a great addition to any coffee table and it's a great way to support the show. So check all that out. If you want to find us on social media, we are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And you can send me an email. I'm at sam@offcamera.com. So tell me what's on your mind, suggest a guest, or give me a good recipe for the holidays. I'd like to impress my wife a little bit with my cooking skills. And I want to thank everybody that helps on the show. It's been quite a year. Everyone's put in a lot of hard work and, they are the reason that we can put out a show every week. That's Nathan Shields, doing sound, editing, all kinds of technical things. Michaela Galvin, helping with cameras, doing all our graphic design, and in general, making us look good around here. Laura Kemper runs the whole studio, which is no easy task. Amy Jones is our intellectual in the bunch. She's our writer and researcher, and she makes us look smart. Crawford Shippey is our producer, and we certainly wouldn't have a show without him because he somehow figures out how to get all these guests to come to Santa Monica and talk to me. So thank you, Crawford. And Kara Johnson, who listens to all these conversations and types them out and creates transcriptions so that we can work off of them. That's a thankless task, so I'm going to change that right now. Thank you, Kara. And of course, a special thank you to Matt Davidson, who just keeps the parking lot in front of our office swept clean of all debris and make sure that the moment the guests come to the show, they are not walking through an excessive amount of dust or trash. Thank you, Matt, for all the hard work you do around here. And we have a real treat for you next week. We're going to be joined by actress and author Octavia Spencer.
I have a hard time walking into a very crowded, frenzied situation.
Really?
So whenever I step out of a car and there's lights flashing and cameras and people screaming, you know, look over here, I want to get off that carpet as soon as possible. But if you're terrified of everything and you don't venture out and try to get past that fear, you will never accomplish anything, not anything.
Once you hear her story, you might be surprised that she became either an actor or a writer, let alone both. She struggled with both dyslexia and stage fright all her life. Her big break as an actress came with playing a maid in The Help, and it was a role that won her the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. Her next Oscar nomination came with her performance as a NASA mathematician in Hidden Figures. Both were important stories, and both made her worry about being confined to certain eras and characters. So why would she agree to play a cleaning lady in her latest film? We'll talk about her career and creative choices, including her decision to make a redheaded white girl the hero of her detective series for kids. See you next time, off camera.